Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from May 23, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is the second of three classes on what is meant by becoming in relation to dependent origination. There's a related article on my website called Becoming Explained Three Suttas. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So like I said earlier, I gave the first talk in this series on Saturday in relation to the Loka Sutta. And tonight, I'll talk about the Bhava Sutta. But let me just lay the foundation in the background. I know I talk about dependent origination often, but this is what we're referring to. And dependent origination isn't the only place that the Buddha talks about becoming. And again, the problem with that word is there's hardly ever a modifier after becoming, so it's left to interpretation. And so whatever your... Welcome, Judy. I'm glad you made it.
Nice for you to drop in. That's not very graceful.
Whatever your desire that Buddhism should be, you usually start fitting it in there after becoming it. So it has all kinds of magical and mystical connotations when it's taken out of context. When the Buddha's sole purpose of teaching is to recognize in a profound way the nature of suffering and our contributions to suffering and distraction, and to develop wisdom where there was once ignorance, and a specific ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So you could say that the process of becoming that the Buddha is referring to is the becoming empty of ignorance to gain wisdom of Four Noble Truths. So again, just to go over the dependent origination again, from the Paticca-samuppada Vibhanga Sutta. From ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrication. So again, a very specific... Dependent origination is something like most suttas, that if you just read that, it would have almost no meaning at all, and you'd have no way of understanding how to apply it. And right there, from ignorance comes fabrication. Does anybody really know? If you don't know anything else about Buddhism, what do you know? What does that mean? Really doesn't mean anything, because it's the implication is that we're just completely ignorant people. And of course, the Buddha's not stating that. But in context, you understand that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths that leads to fabrications or assumptions about who we are in relation to the world. From ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. And again, out of context, we might be thinking that the Buddha's talking about the New Age notion of this grand cosmic consciousness that we're all growing into and we're all going to realize just by living in the world. And of course, he's not talking about that. What he's referring to is an ongoing thought process that is ignorant of Four Noble Truths, that is developed or rooted in these assumptions, these false assumptions rooted in ignorance. So the Buddha is describing an ongoing process that begins in ignorance. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. The Pali word is namarupa. Name and form simply, the easiest explanation is name and form is self-referential views. We've identified ourselves as this is me, this body is me, and everything that is produced from that view is a self-referential view. Remember that it is rooted in ignorance and founded in assumptions. And these are wrong. The assumptions are part of wrong view. They're false assumptions. From name and form or self-referential views, as a requisite condition, comes the sixth sense base. Those that are on retreat will remember in the Nagara Sutta, the Buddha talks about how he got stuck in the feedback loop between name and form, self-referential views, and that ongoing consciousness. And he states very clearly, there's no way to get out of it unless you have something to do, another way of looking at these views. And that's where the Eightfold Path comes in. From the sixth sense base, as a requisite condition, comes contact. From contact, as a requisite condition, comes feeling. And again, the reference to feeling here is not just physical feeling or an emotional or mental reaction. It's any type of disturbance in the mind that we're talking about. Again, rooted in that initial ignorance, fueled by fabrications. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. And so now We've had an experience rooted in ignorance, fueled by fabrications, that and it creates a pleasant feeling, and we want more of that, whatever that experience was, or it creates a negative feeling, a hurtful feeling, and we'll do anything we can at this point to not have that feeling. But remember, all of that is rooted in ignorance, and if we truly understood impermanence, we wouldn't have the reaction in the first place, because we would understand that those things that we're hoping to hold on to that give us pleasure, they're all impermanent, so why hold on to them? And those things that we're starting to develop a relationship, a negative relationship or an aversive relationship, well, if we understand impermanence, there'd be no reason for that. We understand that if we just take a breath, in most cases, the feeling is going to leave. And or even in something that is continual, we understand that there's impermanence that is being obscured by that continuity. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. Now, we want more of what's giving us pleasure. We're clinging to it. Or we want the opposite, which is another aspect of clinging. We create an aversion over what's bringing us displeasure. It's still trying to maintain this point of view now. Now we get to the heart of the matter. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. Becoming what? Where's the modifier? Well, from becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. Now we have to remember, the Buddha's not talking about creating a future birth, at least not so much, that there's a component of that. But it's to bring mindfulness to what we're giving birth to in this moment. And if what we're giving birth to in this moment is rooted in ignorance, what are we giving birth to? What are we becoming? We're becoming more ignorant. Anything rooted in ignorance can only contribute to more ignorance unless we find a way to recognize and change that, those assumptions leading to consciousness, leading to the whole causative chain. Is that clear? We're getting there. And again, that birth that we're talking about is not so much a future birth, although that's a component of it. What's most important is what we're giving birth to in this moment. Because if we deal with what we're giving birth to in this moment, we don't need to worry about what we might give birth to in a speculative future lifetime. From birth as a requisite condition comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. That's how the Buddha describes suffering. He describes dukkha that way. What is dukkha? Dukkha is birth, sickness, aging, and death. Dukkha is not getting what you want. Dukkha is getting what you don't want. And then he would always conclude that by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. The five clinging aggregates, again, the simple explanation is the personal experience of suffering. Is the five clinging aggregates. So now we've gone from ignorance through this process of 12 causative links to experience a life of confusion, delusion, and ongoing unsatisfactory experiences, dukkha. What's the solution? If it's rooted in ignorance, then wisdom. If ignorance of Four Noble Truths, then it's gaining wisdom of Four Noble Truths that ends this process. And that's the key part about becoming. So let me read the Bhava Sutta. Where is it? There it is. So, even during the Buddha's time, there was confusion regarding the meaning of becoming. Here, Ananda, the Buddha's cousin and chief attendant, asked for clarity. On one occasion, Ananda went to the Buddha, bowed, and sat to one side. He was unsure of the meaning of becoming, and so asked the Buddha, "Becoming, becoming, to what extent is there becoming? Ananda, if there were no karma ripening within the feeling property, would the feeling property be noticed?" He's referring to the physical body that is animated through the sixth sense base. This is the feeling property. My comment here. Karma is a present unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present quality of mindfulness. The feeling property or form property and the formless property relates to the five clinging aggregates. The formless property also relates to the arising and passing away of stress. Karma and rebirth, this refers to the book, Karma and Rebirth is explained further on. Ananda replies, "No wise teacher, in this way karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture." So karma, ongoing experience rooted in ignorance that we're experiencing, is the field that we're continually planting with the seed of consciousness rooted in ignorance, an ongoing thought process. Is that clear? It's an interesting metaphor.
Can you say it again?
Karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. So how do we grow a plant? One of the main thing that a plant needs, above everything else, is moisture. It needs water, doesn't it? We're providing the continual moisture for our own ongoing ignorance through craving. Again, remember the context. The Buddha is explaining becoming, becoming, becoming. To what extent is there becoming? To the extent that we continue craving. Craving rooted in ignorance. Very clear and direct. One of the things that's surprising to me is how, if you read the Buddha's teachings, if that's where your focus is, you really can't come to a misunderstanding of becoming, can you? But if you don't, you can continually become more ignorant. Joe?
I do right at the moment because it doesn't address after you're awakened, because then becoming would be different.
That's it. We were talking about that earlier. Each moment holds the potential. Depending on the present quality of our mind, to become more ignorant if we don't have a way of recognizing that ignorance and changing it, or to become awakened. So I got a question probably a couple months ago now from a student. Did the Buddha continue to meditate after he awakened? In fact, I think the question was, why would the Buddha meditate after he awakened? And my answer was, why wouldn't he? Because each moment, whether we're awakened or not, holds that potential to continue to either develop or maintain the establishment of awakening. And how do we do it? With a well-concentrated mind. So again, we've got to get rid of all the mystical connotations of what awakening means. Awakening means gaining full human maturity. It means ending all ignorant views and living within the framework of the Eightfold Path that establishes the Four Noble Truths in our lives. So even post-awakening, we're still involved in the world.
So what you said about becoming, though, refers only to someone who is not awakened.
It depends on the context. Because in the context of developing awakening, the only thing we should be concerned about is, am I contributing to my own, to becoming more ignorant, or am I contributing to becoming awakened? And that really is the only thing. The question that you ask, and even that my student asked, is probably a question that the Buddha would answer this way. Meaning he would have sat silent to show that the question itself has an implication that is rooted in ignorance. And I'm not saying that you're ignorant. It has no relevance to developing awakening. A simple way of saying that is, once you're awakened, you'll know. And if you're concerned about what the state of awakening is in a way that you start speculating of it, that speculation is only going to contribute to distraction.
I just want to know what becoming means.
I hope you understand by the end of this talk. In this reference, it simply means becoming awakened. Let me continue with the sutta. And then, and please ask the question again if it's not clear. Let me go back to that one line. In this way, karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. The consciousness of human beings rooted in ignorance and bound by craving is established in wrong view. Another word for wrong view is ignorant view. These are the Buddha's words, by the way. Established in wrong view, renewed becoming is produced. Renewed becoming what? Becoming more ignorant. And it's these self-referential views, you weren't there, in the Gara Sutta, the Buddha talks about getting stuck in these self-referential views, this feedback loop. And so all that we're doing is continually feeding that ignorance, and we can only become more ignorant. We renew it with every thought rooted in that ignorance. Is that clear? Or is it getting clear?
I look at that as you can either, in every moment, you can either go this way or that.
Yep.
And you can either follow your conditioned mind or your assumptions or, insert whatever else, and continue the cycle of suffering. Or with continued awareness, you say, aha, in that moment, and you are very aware that you have a choice. I don't know how to choose awakening yet, but I feel that that's my choice, that if I continue to do what I've been doing, I already know that doesn't work, and it's based on assumptions and fabrications. And so right now I'm trying to just do nothing in that moment in the hopes of becoming more aware, so that what I'm really doing is moving, just by not going left, I'm moving on a path toward awakening.
Yes. And that's the, yeah, that's the path. And it really is that simple. And again, taking in the context of what the Buddha's teaching, it's obvious what becoming means. Why are we engaged in the Eightfold Path? To become awakened, to become Buddha, hence the name of the book. And so, looking at that, why would there be any other meaning to becoming? What do we want to become? Do we want to become awakened, fully mature human beings, or do we want to become something else? Now, if our motivation is towards some mystical or magical becoming, we are going, our conditioned thinking is going to substitute merely awakening for something much grander that feeds the ego personality. Or if we're simply stuck in a belief system that insists on self-referential views, such as developing Buddhahood or an inner Buddha nature, then that's what we'll substitute for becoming. But that leads us away from the Eightfold Path, doesn't it? Because if I have an inner Buddha nature or an inner Buddhahood or whatever the practice might be, if it's just endless meditation where at some point I'll spontaneously awaken, then there's no reason at all to develop an Eightfold Path, is there? Again, it has to be seen in context. But everything the Buddha taught has to be seen in context, or it's only going to lead to something that is not useful. A good example, I don't want to get into that right now. Liz.
So the way I understood it when we were away on retreat was that the Buddha described what it was like before he awakened, and that was that he had these self-referential thoughts, he had all of the same kinds of thoughts that we sort of fight with and question and slay and, you know, all those things. But that once he became awakened, that he no longer had even those thoughts.
Yep.
And that at that point, so if there was a word, becamed, he became, and at that point he was living in true skillfulness and knowledge of the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths in every moment. And that, to me, that's what awakening is, and that's when it gets, I imagine the atmosphere being just a skillful way of moving through life without the need to defend yourself or wrestle with the thoughts anymore, so that it's this sort of peaceful place because there's no more of the antagonism of dukkha happening.
Yeah.
So if it's becoming that we talk about in terms of prior to awakening, then it's something else. Once we become awake.
That was my question.
Yes. We become Buddha. And again, we don't become a Buddha.
Right.
Buddha describes, it describes a being, a human being who awakened, but it also describes a quality of mind of an awakened human being.
Right. So this was a key point for me at the retreat. Was the moment I realized that it gave me a reference point of the Buddha being in the same place we are, having thoughts that come and go, and that you try to defend, and you involve in dukkha and unskillfulness, but that the move towards enlightenment is the I don't want to say absolute skillfulness, but it's the skillfulness.
It's what you do when all those things come up. How you react?
Well, no, because they don't even happen anymore. That was the point that John said that I was like, because to me that helped me visualize what enlightenment is, because he didn't even have the thoughts anymore.
So the Buddha described the quality.
Yeah. That's what I said.
Describes an awakened human being, a fully mature human being, using the same similar words, released or unbound, as if released or unbound from clinging. And he describes the quality of mind of an awakened, fully mature human being in very simple and direct terms. Nothing magical or mystical about this. Calm or peaceful. Another word is equanimity, ongoing equanimity. So again, the question, and it's answered in some schools as a misapplication of what becoming means. What happens when you awaken? Some schools teach that you just vanish. You instantly vanish. You're no longer here. Well, the Buddha awakened, and he spent 45 years of the most effective and, I think, important life that any human being ever lived. And I think this will help answer your question, Joe. What happens when you awakened? You live the life as an awakened human being. Why do we? You might sense a little frustration in my voice. I don't intend it, but why do we need more than that? We're human beings. Isn't that enough? It's only a self-referential ego self will say, "Well, there's got to be more to the. There's got to be a couple carnivals or something, or maybe a game of pool every now and then. There's got to be something more than just a common peaceful mind, doesn't there?"
So I have a question, John. You know, and what's on my mind is what happened in Manchester.
Yes, I don't mean to smile about that. I was thinking about that all day and wondering if I was going to talk about it. So please continue.
So in a situation like that, would the Buddha be able to, you know, if you're fully awakened, can you respond to that in a dispassionate way? Where you just walk in and you just start helping or doing whatever?
The Ratana
feel the horror of it?
You feel it. The Ratana Sutta explains that very clearly. It wasn't quite as awful a situation or immediate. Remember, the Buddha didn't live in some utopic world.
Right.
It was just as violent as the world is today.
Right.
And he was deeply concerned about that, about those kind of things. So this isn't a way of being detached and being, what's that word, flippant about these types of things. Like, you know, poor souls. You know, at least didn't happen to me. Or it's all. He understood that what occurred there is described in the Four Noble Truths. The First Noble Truth says dukkha occurs. Everything from mild disappointment to extreme, brutal acts like this. And they're rooted in the Second Noble Truth, which explains where it came from. Who did it? Someone craving to an incredibly ignorant view. Feeling justified, craving, and clinging to those views that justified the action. It's clearly explained. And just because it's explained doesn't mean that it's excused. So you can hear, now you can hear the frustration in my voice.
But dispassion isn't a negative word in this context.
No, it doesn't mean detachment. It
just means
it means that you're seeing it clearly. So.
Right.
I can't tell you how the Buddha would have responded. I can tell you how I did, which was incredible sadness, thinking about the little girls that got killed, but also thinking about the mind of this person that did this and all the other people around. Just because they're the perpetrators doesn't mean that they deserve our hate. What they deserve is our understanding from where it came from so we can learn from it.
Yeah,
of course, it's an awful thing that happens. Dukkha occurs. Why does it happen? Because of ignorance. What's the solution?
Well, that's
The solution first, the solution first is for responsible parties to do their best to protect each other, because we're living in a violent world. It's silly to say, well, we shouldn't worry about those types of things. We shouldn't start trying to protect people. We should. It's the first thing that the Buddha taught. When he advised kings and leaders, even when he advised kings that were going into war, he didn't say, don't do that, because he knew that the war that they were contemplating was inevitable. What he did say was, when you win the war, to treat the people that you vanquish in a compassionate way, in a reasonable way. So I get a little bit off the track. What would the Buddha do if he was in Manchester and across the street when it happened? The first thing he would do is attend to the people that were around him. And then if there were people interested, maybe a day or a week later, he would teach them why it happened. I keep saying it continually, and I'm not saying that because I'm trying to preach to you. The most loving thing I can do for myself and for everyone else in the world, including who's ever bent on terrorism, is to take to the Dhamma and awaken, because it's the only possible remedy to what's going on. We've been trying for all of mankind to end violence, to legislate against violence. Mm-hmm. It hasn't worked. And it never truly worked. Right now, in the situation we're in on this world, the best we can do is to hope that the governmental institutions can protect us. Because if they can't, then that's going to happen. We're not at that point yet where we are, as a global society, free of craving and clinging, which leads to acts rooted in ignorance.
Does anyone happen to know if any of our political leaders do meditate? Does anybody know?
So I'm sure some of them do. But
probably meditates.
There's not nearly enough. And it's a fair question, Ellen. Yeah. Helen, but yeah. It's we know that it's not just meditation alone.
And it's not,
you know,
this. Yeah,
they're not there. If there was a glimmer of recognition of where it comes from, then we could start becoming a more reasonable society, a truly enlightened society. But we're caught up in concepts and theories and all the rest of it. There's a reason why we should recognize hate as hate and not make it something else.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why we should recognize incredibly deluded thinking and not make it something else. Part of the entire Dhamma is to see things clearly, see things as they really are.
That's why I know a lot of people who are involved in settling refugees, because that's the only way to deal with this is to love other people. So, you know, you keep people... If you show people hate and fear, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, the love or the compassion that we show everyone has to be rooted in an understanding of where this stuff comes from.
Yeah.
And again, the Buddha described all of this 2,600 years ago. He set out to try to understand, you know, not just why people feel bad or have a bad day, but where does this come from? This is what shocked him into seeking. Where does this aggression, this competitiveness come from? Why do we do it? Because we're ignorant. We don't understand. And then we get caught up in ideologies that justify it, and we think that this is a reasonable thing. The person that did this believed sincerely in what he was doing. Just because it's... just because I can say, well, that's insane to believe it, and maybe it is, I mean, I think it is, doesn't change the fact that it's what occurs. So it's ridiculous for me to say all those people are crazy and it just should stop.
What a loser.
The ongoing, he's not the only one that engages in that ridiculous rhetoric that somehow that's going to have an effect.
What I gather is, and it's one thing that keeps me coming back, is this
teaches me to not like myself, and to that self-loathing is a like a common thing. And what I hear in the practice of the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Steps is a way to truly embrace who I am, all that I am, and not in the I-making kind of way, just what is. And until I do that, and to me that's the becoming part of it, is I can't really understand what you're talking about, or I can't understand you, or I can't have compassion for another. I got so mad at my father at one point in my life when I was about 22. I to this day, don't know psychologically what happened to me, but I just was beyond rage. And I recently realized that my life kind of came forth from that moment in my relationship with my dad. And just in the last, actually, recently, more recently, I realized, wow, I can't expect others to forgive me until I forgive my dad, until I understand my dad. And I've been, since this kind of came upon me, it's been an unfolding of all the reasons. I mean, my mom always said I was just like my father, and so I really hated that part of me. And I didn't, and I played it down, and, you know, that which we resist persists, and so I kept doing what I was doing. But the thing that I'm mentioning this for is when you say the guy believed in what he was doing, I believe, my compassion, my understanding of that fellow is more that he was like beyond rage about something, and he was just reacting with all the hate that was in him. And unless I have experienced some kind of hate like that, where I'm over the, you know, what is it? Over the moon, not over.
Over the top.
Over the top, yeah. So, you know, just completely out of it. I can't really understand why a person would do something like that. But when I get in touch with my own lividness at what was going on with my dad, I can. It's an insane behavior. What that man did was insane. He was not legally saying any. Go off on tangents there, but what the Buddha says to what I'm hearing is, I don't have to do that. I don't have to let ego so occupy my mind that I can't be in the moment and accept the moment and love the moment and love who I am. Love that my knees hurt. Love that, and I'm not, the word, don't, I don't talk Buddhistic really. So, but it's just really appreciating, you know, with all that I am, you know, with all my consciousness, what is? And from that, it's like where you are, where another person is, there's some part of me that understands, that has touched on that feeling. And it's, I don't think awakening means you don't feel anymore at all. I think you can just, that's what I think you're saying, John, is you can get just as angry and just as fed up, but then it's like you begin to see in the situation, you understand with a compassion of something within yourself that you can relate to it. to me, that's what meditation does, is it finds all those sinews and things that are hiding in my body of, there isn't anything that's, I've thought of killing someone. I've thought of how to kill them. I've actually thought it through. I've thought of doing a lot of really nasty things. It's in me. But I don't, what the more, to me, that's the ego thing in me. And what I've, what the, may I be filled with love and kindness. First, may I first be filled, before I pray it for you or ask it for you or anybody else, I have to have that. And to me, that's the foundation and my understanding of the Buddhist, learning to love who I am, as is. And then I have something to love you with.
Thank you. Helen, did I get off track with what you were saying, what you asked me?
I think, from what I understand, in a horrible crisis situation, the Buddha would be in a state of calm, would assess the situation, and do what he needed to do, what needed to be done to bring compassion to those around him.
Well, I think he would still feel. If he was sad, he would cry. If he would, you know, he could be there in the present.
The Buddha would recognize, the Buddha awakened to dependent origination, which says from ignorance through 12 observable causative links, all manner of confusion, delusion, and suffering arises. And he would recognize, and we would do well to recognize, that it is ignorance that caused all of that to happen, all of it.
Right, so that's the understanding of, the assessing, the understanding of what the cause was.
But that would allow him to act correctly,
skillfully
in a meaningful way. And
right.
So he would address, just like the Ratana Sutta teaches us, the Sutta on the Three Refuges, he would address the physical needs of the people that he could help, understanding that he can't help everyone. So that the First Noble Truth states that dukkha occurs. While we can find and point to the individual that strapped a bomb on him as the cause of that individual horrible incident, the world is responsible for the incident. Dukkha occurs. Why does dukkha occur in the world? Because the world is craving and clinging. When you, the fire discourse that we went over on the retreat, the world is a flame. The ear is a flame. The mouth is a flame. The nose is a flame. We're aflame with this passion. In that way, there's really no blame, or there shouldn't be any blame, but there should be an understanding if we really want to bring this to cessation in the world. It's the only thing that really matters. I mean, and what they're doing also matters. In other words, I heard that they arrested a couple more people that they think were involved. That should happen. But we should arrest people and put them through the system, whatever we decide as a society we should do, whether it's 20 years in jail or 100 lashes, it doesn't really matter. But we should understand where those people are coming from too. Because that's the only way we can change it. The awakened view that the Buddha would have and that we are all developing here is an understanding of the nature of suffering. When the Buddha described awakening in a different way in relation to the Eightfold Path, he says right view is a profound understanding of suffering, meaning all of it. Not just the things that we wanted, that we accept, all of it. Where does it come from? Where does this guy come from? Where does all of this come from? Ultimately, it's an understanding that as a consequence of living in the world, a bomb may go off at our feet. That's the world we live in. And that doesn't mean we should walk around foolishly. It does mean we should understand this is the world we live in. What can we do? The most loving thing we can do is take to the Dhamma and awaken, and then hopefully contribute. You asked a good question. I wonder how many of these politicians or people in power meditate. There's probably more and more, but there's not enough. How can we change it? We can't legislate it. What we can do is be an example. Let me get back to the sutta.
Oh, I thought you were finished.
Well, I do want to finish the sutta. But this is all part of this. The world is becoming more and more violent, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The same violence that was there 2,600 years ago is still here, but it is becoming more. Because why? Because it's becoming more and more ignorant. There's more and more established, hardened views rooted in ignorance, at least it appears that way to me, than ever before.
Well, it's a smaller world, so you hear all the ignorant views.
Well, that's true. So there wasn't the global communication that we have today during the time of the Buddha.
Every ignorant view.
Let me go back to just put this back in context so we can finish the sutta, because it's important. In this way, karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. I got to comment again on this. If you look at the karma of the world and the consciousness of the seed, it's the consciousness of that hate and violence. And it was craving for an expression of that hate and violence that blew up in Manchester. And the Buddha described it 2,600 years ago. So, you know, in that way, karma isn't just individual. Karma is playing out on the world stage. The consciousness of human beings rooted in ignorance and bound by craving is established in wrong view. Established in wrong view, renewed becoming is produced. Becoming what? Becoming more and more violent. Expressing that ignorance. There is no karma ripening in the form property. If there was no karma ripening in the form property, would the form property be noticed? In other words, if there wasn't ignorance ripening, coming to bear, would it be expressed? Of course it wouldn't. How do you got to deal with it, though? My comment here. This one sentence contains the implication of the entire Dhamma. With no karma left to ripen, there are no self-referential views clinging to form. With no self-referential views remaining, no self-identity clinging to impermanent phenomena, the form property now is simply a reference point for life dispassionately unfolding. And that answers the question about what happens. Now, an awakened human being, their experience of life is simply as a reference point without taking anything personal. A reference point to life as life occurs. And in that extreme example, I guess this really isn't a good example for this, isn't it? In that extreme example, then you are just a self that is experiencing what is occurring, and you act mindfully from it. And you don't act from a place of hatred. You don't act from a place of fear. You act from a place that is knowing. Knowing what? Knowing reality. Knowing that if this occurred, it's because this is what's going on in the world. It's not, it shouldn't have occurred. This is what occurred. And you understand why it occurred. And you also understand, because you've dealt with it yourself, how to prevent it in the future in yourself. We talked about on retreat. If we want to establish peace in the world, where do we establish it? First, in ourselves. We have to become peaceful if we want the world to become peaceful. That's a simple equation, isn't it?
Yeah.
It seems impossible because there's only one of me, but this is the only thing that I have real control over. I'm sorry, dude. Let me finish this. To put it in context. If there is no karma ripening in the form property, would the form property be noticed? You wouldn't even notice it, would you? Ananda answers, no, wise teacher. In this way, karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. The consciousness of human beings rooted in ignorance and bound by craving is established in wrong view. Established in wrong view, renewed becoming is produced. Again, just reminding that if whatever is rooted in ignorance can only produce ignorance. It can only become more ignorant. If there is no karma ripening in the formless property, would the formless property be noticed? No, wise teacher. In this way, karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. The consciousness of human beings rooted in ignorance is bound by craving and is established in wrong view or in ignorant view. Established in wrong view or ignorance, renewed becoming is produced. Established in wrong view, renewed becoming is produced. That's the Buddha's final answer to Ananda. It answers the whole question of what does becoming mean. If it is rooted in wrong view, the only thing that's possible to become is more ignorant. But remember, the Buddha didn't teach how to become more ignorant. He taught how to end ignorance, how to empty ignorance. So, presented in the right context, we develop the Eightfold Path and become awakened. We empty ourselves of ignorance. That's the potential that each moment has. Let me just read my comments to finish that part of it. The past intentional actions are karma, providing the environment for ongoing thinking or consciousness rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths and sustained, giving sustenance by craving, meaning water, the moisture. One can only become continually subject to confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointment and unsatisfactory experiences, in a word, dukkha. But, again, the Buddha didn't just state that we're ignorant and we're stuck in suffering. He pointed that out so that we identify the problem, so we know what the problem is. I'm ignorant. I'm ignorant of something very specific. I'm ignorant of Four Noble Truths. I don't understand them yet. And when the Buddha describes Four Noble Truths, he concludes with saying the path to the cessation of suffering is the Eightfold Path. It's the only path he ever taught. But as most of you know, it seems difficult at times to develop the Eightfold Path, but it's certainly not impossible. The Buddha didn't teach something that human beings couldn't develop. That really would have been a waste of 45 years of a human life, wouldn't it? But he taught a simple and direct path that anybody can develop, and to ease that type of mind that can lead to those extreme behaviors. Or even the behavior that we have that continues to contribute to unsatisfactory experiences and not seeing the occurrences in the world from a right view, to understand that, to have a reasonable response to something as brutal as that. Because we understand where it comes from. How do we understand where it came from? Because we understand the nature of our own suffering. Diane just explained that very eloquently. Because we understand the nature of our own suffering, we understand the suffering and the causes of suffering in the world. And that, we should finish this on a high note, because it is possible. It's possible to extract ourselves from that ignorance, and it's possible to be an example to those around us. And it's the only hope, I think, the only hope we have. We certainly, I'm going to stop here because I could go on, but it was an awful thing to hear. It's an awful thing to live in the world with that type of violence, isn't it? I think I've talked about this before. It reminded me of the same, thinking about the people around that were terrorized and running out of that place. Remind me of how I felt when I was a little kid walking home and the air raid sirens went off, and living in that type of world. And I think back about that, how the effect that had on me as a human being, to grow up in a world like that, that you think that a siren goes off and the next minute the whole world is blown up.
Yeah.
You know, this happened to, I don't remember, 8 or 9 years old. And it happened not just to me, it happened to all the people that grew up in that time. And it's still happening. It hasn't changed.
No.
Why? Because the world hasn't changed.
But
all the strive, all the things we've tried to do, the legislative systems, the great teachings on enlightenment, you know, all the religions in the world, all the, I'll put a little blame on the Buddhist religions too. Hasn't really changed much, has it? What can we do? Take to the Dhamma and awaken. The only chance we have. It's the only way. That's what I felt when I heard that. I had a momentary feeling, and it was palpable, of hopelessness. And it was a hope like, what the hell am I doing? What good is this? What good is it going there teaching this stuff? Because it's the only hope we have, I think. You know, and if it's just us, it's just us. I don't think that's the case. But it's the only thing we can do. It's the only thing I can do. It's the only thing that creates the next reasonable response, which is understanding. You know, it didn't go to hate. The next thought was that SOB. I felt just as just as much sorrow and compassion for the guy that blew himself up as I did for those little girls they showed pictures of. Awful thing. All rooted in ignorance.
But all the Muslim cab drivers in the area started giving people, showed up at the site and drove people home. And
isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
That's what I heard.
Yeah.
And the whole town opened themselves up for you.
Yeah.
Come and you can, there's refuge here in my home.
Yeah.
That's the underlying true human nature that is obscured by craving and clinging.
Discussing when people behave in a violent way, it's out of the need to express, you know, all the stuff they're clinging to. The anger just comes because they get so desperate.
Yeah.
And
they want the world to know about that desperation.
What is evil? It's not evil. These things develop, the act may be evil, if you make qualify that, but these behaviors, these ways of looking at the world develop over time, and based on all the things we've talked about here, and when you look at it that way, you could see that it can be undone.
It can, but there's only a way to do it.
Yeah.
They don't, this, none of this develops in a vacuum.
Right.
It develops as an aspect of dukkha. Remember how the Buddha described it? Not getting what you want is dukkha. This poor soul wasn't getting what he wanted. And he thought there was only one way to get that. The whole idea of doing that is really insane to me. But this soul believed it. I shouldn't even call him a soul. I don't believe in souls. This person believed that what he was doing was right and was going to somehow now give him what he wanted, because he wasn't getting what he wanted. I'm going to get myself in trouble, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think one of the reasons, one of the strong motivations, and why this is becoming more and more apparent today, is we have this notion that all religions are one thing. And what happens to a person who has a misguided understanding that their religion is particularly special, and there's this ongoing pressure to make religion all one thing, they say, no, I want you to recognize my beliefs are different, and I'm going to blow the hell out of you unless you recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
The opposite, I know it sounds, and maybe you're not going to follow me with this, to me, the essence of intolerance is insisting that my view and your view is exactly the same. That's intolerance. Tolerance is recognizing this is my belief system. That's yours, and I leave you in peace. You don't have to believe what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to come to the ridiculous notion that all beliefs are one belief. This is another, you know, really getting off track. This is the idea of non-duality, that all things are one thing and we're all interconnected. The Buddha taught just the opposite. He taught that everything is discrete. And we should honor our discreteness, shouldn't we? We should let people that have those extreme views feel peaceful in their views rather than saying, you should be different. Of course, when they start acting out, then we have to deal with that. I'm sorry.
And not only should all beliefs be the same, but everybody should treat everybody the same way.
Yeah.
And we should all have the same behavior.
Yep.
That's just not the case.
Yep.
Well, that's the description. I mean, that's the definition of fundamentals, that it's one way.
Yeah. And
it's, so if it's a fundamentalist point of view, then they believe it should be one way.
Yeah.
But I wanted to get back to the sutta. And
good. Thank you.
And the feedback work that we talked about in the at the retreat. And the feedback loop being dependent origination, and that the simplicity of the idea that by interrupting dependent origination, the whole thing falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And that is the skillful use of the Dharma in a daily practice that leads to the ability to live skillfully at every moment. And that's what I think enlightenment is, to live skillfully in every moment, to not be distracted by all the unskillful influences that come through us. Not that we don't feel, but that we don't have to respond. We don't have to engage in one of the, in the concept of dependent origination. So you can, the skill isn't interrupting it,
mm-hmm.
and the interruption is what is what I believe when it's when you're in the. It's what I just said.
Yes, and the way to interrupt it is an Eightfold Path.
Right.
That feedback loop is another word for conditioned thinking,
mm-hmm.
which or confirmation bias. It just describes a feedback loop. And so the Buddha recognized mm-hmm. that, and he considered, how do I teach this? How do I present something that can address the feedback loop that he described in the Nagara Sutta? An Eightfold Path is necessary. Because it provides that middle way between that ongoing back and forth of the feedback loop.
So what this awareness did for me was it made me realize that in the moment, decision making as an unenlightened being, the key things that can get my attention are, what am I doing in this moment? What part of the ignorance am I caught up in? Is it, which one of the Four Noble Truths am I not accepting at this moment? And using the Eightfold Path as another type of feedback loop to interrupt dependent origination.
Yes. That's exactly it. And so what we talked a little bit about this too in a slightly different way. So in that moment, what are you becoming? That's really the only question. Each moment holds the potential to incline our minds towards awakening or to continue ignorance. That really is the only choice we ever have in each and every moment. And then once we awakened, which isn't all that hard, once we awaken, all choices are done with. We don't have the distraction of what should I do, because we rest, as the Buddha described, we rest in a mind of equanimity, ongoing peace, no matter what's occurred. So whether it's a deer running across the road or a bomb goes off, we address the situation mindfully and appropriately. We feel appropriately, so we don't want to hit the deer. We turn the wheel to the right. A bomb goes off. And the appropriate feeling is first fear, and then checking that you might be okay, and then to address the needs of the people around you calmly and peacefully, without giving rise to the distraction of needing anything to be different.
The whole thing of living skillfully from moment to moment, this is my major issue.
You're not alone.
No, I know, but I seem to have more of a... But it's that constant distraction.
Yeah.
Constant. And so the idea now of integrating the meditation with the path, the meditation allows you then to be mindful of your choices.
Exactly.
That's
of the Eightfold Path. That's it.
That's
why we...
That's what I'm trying to do.
You are doing it.
Well, and the funny thing is just this week, I was rooting through a box of books that the kids had taken out of their rooms because they're trying to clean things up. And I said, okay, I didn't read it. Oh, I always meant to read this.
Yeah.
Tuesdays with Maury.
Yeah. Oh, what a nice book.
And
it is a good
book. Oh, that was so depressing. I said, you probably read it too young. So I read it in college or something. Right?
Yeah.
So I started reading it, and the man's a Buddhist. That's all there is to it. I mean, he follows that path. He says every...
because people are asking constantly, how can you handle the fact that you know you're dying and every week you can do less and less and less and less? He goes, I mourn what's passing, I feel it completely, and I move on. I want to live before I die, so if I sat there and worried about it all day, I wouldn't be able to do anything else.
Yep.
So he goes, every morning I cry a little bit, and then I learn to just say, this is the way it is now, and I want to go on living. I want to see my friends, I want to do this, I want to do that. And, you know, I don't know if I would ever get to that point as well as he did, but that was the whole idea of the clinging. He goes, I'm detaching now, he said to this person who was interviewing him. He said, you feel it completely, and then you move on, is kind of what he was saying. And it was just kind of like a little ding went off.
Yeah, another way of saying that feeling completely is that you feel what is appropriate for the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't need to be any different.
But it doesn't need to feel that way all day long,
yeah.
Every day.
Well, you also understand the nature of impermanence.
Yeah.
He's just in that section there, the feeling is there, but it doesn't lead to the craving.
Right.
So you've interrupted dependence.
Right.
Yeah. Again, it's one of the big myths, and it relates directly to becoming, what happens when you awaken. If most people, especially if you're ignorant of what the Buddha taught, you can't even comprehend maintaining a calm and peaceful mind. That seems like, well, you don't feel anything. You know, you feel everything, but it's appropriate for what's occurring. You don't need for yourself or the you don't need yourself or the people and events of your life to be any different than what's occurring. That's peace.
I like the metaphor of, and it took me a couple times, I've heard it a couple times, but and I'm wrapping my head around it, but the idea that our clinging and craving is watering the seed. I mean, it really illuminates the deliberate responsibility we have in creating our own suffering.
Yeah.
Because if you thought for a second that you were watering seeds that would continue your suffering,
You'd go this way. That's the potential each moment has.
And I think that, and going back to becoming, right? So becoming ignorant is to water the seed. And to not water the seed is to be on the path and is skillful. And going back to the path and seeing things in right view. It's those things on the path that allow you to put the watering can down and not go in that direction.
Yeah.
Because you're seeing things properly, you're not clinging and craving, and you know, next thing you know, you're kind of on the path.
Yeah, that's exactly, very good. The Buddha uses the metaphor of a garden and cultivating the garden in a few different suttas. He also uses the word restraint in different suttas in a different situation to mean stop watering.
Right.
Practice restraint. It's up to us. There's no magic to any of this. And the reason why we need what you just described, we need a meditation practice to deepen concentration so we can maintain the refined mindfulness of the path in life situations. Liz, you were just talking about that. Where am I going? If I'm agitated in this moment, is because of wrong speech or wrong view? What is it? Recognize it. And as a Buddha teaches mindfulness, recognize when engaged in wrong or unskillful, name the situation, and enter and remain in skillful view, skillful speech, skillful meditation, etc., etc. It is very simple in that way. And again, the Buddha keeps coming back to that. He said the Paticchasamuppada Sutta is not the only place where he taught dependent origination. He taught it a lot in different situations. The Nagara Sutta is a teaching on dependent origination to reinforce the fact. That's why it came up that I tend to repeat myself on retreat. The reason is, did you ever hear me say that it's ignorance of Four Noble Truths that leads to all manner of suffering? You've heard me say it a million times. It takes a while for it to really sink in, doesn't it? Because we have conditioned thinking. We've kind of all talked, but I want to make sure that everybody had a chance. So, Ram, I'm glad you're here tonight.
I'm good. I think I've thrown in my three pennies.
And the meaning of the Bhava Sutta and the meaning of becoming is clear now? Okay. Judy, do you have anything else?
A couple repetitions probably is going to be
necessary. Yeah, hearing it a few more times might do the trick.
Well, this is it is an important teaching. It's interesting how it developed for me on retreat, because it's always been clear in my mind what becoming, well, not always, but lately, the last little while, I understood in my own mind what becoming means. But I realized on retreat that I've never explained it well enough for people that don't have as broad a context as I do. And so that was really important. And so that led to the article on the three suttas and these talks. So we need to understand that. Judy, do you have anything else?
No,
good to see you.
And I want to thank everyone last week for letting me get everything out of my system. Everyone was very patient. I appreciate that. And I'm trying very hard to be in the moment and not have... I tend to immediately go, oh my God, this has to happen. And I'm trying to just back off. The problems that I have in my life didn't come overnight. They're not going to go away overnight. And I'm just going to try. And I'm trying to also practice restraint in how I talk about things, because I was getting very angry a lot in the past few months, and it wasn't helping. So I am trying to get more active as opposed to more angry.
Good for you, Judy.
It's not quite there yet. I still get angry, of course, but I'm trying not to just, you know, there's so much anger already. My throwing the anger in there isn't helping him.
Nope.
So that's the way I'm looking at it. It doesn't solve anything and doesn't help anybody else.
Good for you. You're developing this whole thing nicely. There's time for everything, you know. I remember there's a book I read many years ago by Alvin Toffler, Future Shock. He said, time is a currency of exchange that makes all things possible. We have all the time in the world to awaken. We might as well do it right now. Wait, Mary, good to see you.
Great to be here. What a great class. It's all I have to say.
Thank you. Helen, good to see you.
Thank you, John. Good to be here. Good to see everyone. And good to hear everybody's feedback and journey journals.
Mm-hmm.
I've been booking hotel rooms for a conference I'm going to, so I have this image now of every time you step into an elevator, you have a choice. You're going to go up or you're going down. And then, if you make the wrong choice, it's 8 floors. You can get out at any one.
That's right. Yep. Yeah. You can interrupt it
at
any
right.
time.
So that's my image for today. That's my cartoon bubble for today.
Thank you, Helen. Diane, good to see you.
I'm glad to be here, and I appreciate your steadfastness and love in teaching. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Bless you. Bless you.
Bonnie?
My mother would say, it's true, pull your left ear. I don't know what that means. So I have a lot of different thoughts.
Excuse me.
But in response to Helen, a friend of mine who practicing Buddhist and had a sangha and came to it, and she wrote a book called Murder as a Call to Love. Her cousins were murdered, and her family was also quite horrified that she would publish this and write about it, because they were not in the same place where she was. But she went to the prison and started working at the prison to teach writing, and so that whole idea of it's a call to love. I mean, it's really, I understand how she can do that, and there's a part of me that I guess still, I want to be able to see compassion, and I often always give way to the underdog and can rationalize how something can be possible, but I guess we all have our own evils. So that's that. But in relationship to becoming, you know, I can see it. I can see it. And, but sometimes I just get lassoed and snagged into, like, you know, it's like the more you struggle, you get into a knot. And I know that I know I don't have to struggle with the knot, and if I just let it go, it'll open up and relax. But I still had to not get snagged. Like, it's like a fish on the end of the line, even though he doesn't know he's going to be released. You know, but he's flailing and flailing and flailing. If you flail too much, you got to rip in his mouth, and so eventually I'll be released because I'm trying to become aware of it. So it's ongoing. So some days more, some days I'm on the other side of the number one.
Yeah, that's just the way it is. And when you're caught up in it, you remember that in this moment, I can become whatever I want. Thank you. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to see everyone. I don't really have anything to add to what I've said before, but just thank you for teaching it 12 ways of Sunday. Mm-hmm. Obviously something has gotten through, so thank you.
You're welcome. Lorna, good to see you.
Explaining the whole thing tonight, but another round of these three teachings would be a benefit to me. But it's getting a little bit.
I agree. Yeah. Thank you. Becoming just points to the potential each moment has. Joe, good to see you tonight. Did the evening answer that initial question? Or at least help bring some clarity?
It didn't answer the question that I asked. But that's okay.
What was the question?
What has become?
No, it was, well, yeah, but based on the metaphor of field being karma and seed being consciousness and the nourishment, and then becoming would be giving birth to another ignorant moment. It seemed that within the context of the metaphor that the cycle could not be broken, and when I asked about an awakened person, it wasn't because I suppose that at some point I would have to look at it that way, because quite frankly I don't imagine that will ever be the case, but because I thought from that point of view it might help me to understand that becoming doesn't necessarily have to be becoming another moment of ignorance, that possibly
yes.
that the metaphor was not stuck in that cycle.
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. So prior to awakening, we all are experiencing the effect of our karma, meaning the karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present state of our mindfulness, what we're holding in mind. So going back to the metaphor, karma is the field that we're in right now. But our consciousness can be altered or moderated by what we're holding in mind. And so if we're watering the seed of consciousness in the field of karma with concentration and mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, then we're diminishing what's growing in the field. We're diminishing our karma to the point an awakened human being has extinguished the results of their karma. And once that's done, then there will be no more birth of another moment rooted in ignorance. So again, we're using terms. Karma can be a confusing term, but again, it just means what I said it means. And so the metaphor or the result of the field, what's growing in the field, is dependent on what we're holding in mind. And if we're holding in mind the framework of the Eightfold Path, then we're moving towards developing awakening in the field where there was once only the weeds of karma.
Boy, that was pretty funny. Becoming is always becoming another ignorant moment.
Or if we have, again, this is the reason why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path and didn't just say, you're all ignorant unless you meditate or unless you recognize that you're ignorant, because he understood the conditioned thinking. He understood that we're stuck in this field that's growing weeds. So each moment holds a potential to continue karma and continue ignorance, or if we develop the Eightfold Path, which is founded or supported by concentration, the eighth factor, if we develop the Eightfold Path, then we can start inclining our minds towards awakening. So becoming is either, as Mary says, it's either left or right. You can either continue ignorance, or you can develop the Eightfold Path. Again, it's a process. Develop the Eightfold Path and turn right towards awakening. That's the whole point of becoming. It's what the Buddha just described to Ananda.
Stop watering.
Yeah, stop craving and clinging. And you have to take craving and clinging in the right context. Craving for what? Craving is ultimately craving for maintaining self-referential views rooted in ignorance. And then once we create any experience, clinging to that experience. So it's not just craving chocolate cake, it's craving for maintenance of this self-referential ego self. Look up the Nagara Sutta, because I think you'll find that helpful, because that's where the Buddha talks about his own awakening and describing this process in a way, I think, better than I can. But that's what that means. That's what becoming means. What are we going to become? You know, it's the great question that we have. Do I want to become awakened, or do I want to continue ignorance? And there's no moral judgment there. Every one of us has the right to, it's our choice. Nobody can take that choice away. Do I want to continue ignorance? It's up to me.
And that we can interrupt that ignorance using the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path.
Yeah, and according to what the Buddha taught and what I believe, the only way to interrupt that ignorance is the Eightfold Path. I've yet to see anything or anybody been able to extract themselves from ignorance without the path.
But another way of saying that, that the cessation of dukkha is possible,
yep,
is to say that the understanding of ignorance as it relates to dependent origination, that you have a choice to interrupt that ignorance at any moment. So
yep.
The way I looked at it when I was thinking about it at the retreat was that any time I find myself in a situation of what I call discomfort, which could be having just wrong speech or in a clinging of craving, I have to look towards myself and I say, what is it at this moment that I'm being ignorant about, and which of the characteristics of the Eightfold Path do I need to insert at this point, because then it'll interrupt that whole feedback loop I woke up this morning and was talking with my husband, and very early on in the morning went into wrong speech, and I stopped and I said, this is not how I want to start my day. And, you know, I just sort of interrupted it. I said, because the more you get into this, the louder wrong speech sounds. And the more you feel it, it feels bad.
Yeah.
You just tasted vinegar or something.
Yeah,
it just sticks with you.
I did it last night. As soon as I did it, I saw my husband's eyes go, oh, crap.
And if you can, even if everyone around you isn't so forgiving of your misspeaking or whatever, you can at least be compassionate with yourself and try to. Mm-hmm. But the fact that, so what my point is that you could say that, you know, within the Four Noble Truths, the cessation of suffering is possible. Okay, that's one way to say it. But another way to say it is that dependent origination can be interrupted through the skillful use of the Dhamma.
Yep.
And so now you've got the same story told two different ways. And
I like the simple one. It works for me.
But it's different for, and we had that conversation at the retreat, because Jen saw it differently. Maura saw it differently. And they both, I felt like they were sort of correcting me, but I felt that's what they were doing, but I didn't take it that way because I knew what was working for me.
Yeah.
And that they're entitled to, you know, in their own interpretation of it. But I was just so grateful that I found a way to understand the two same points in two different ways. And it made it more tangible to me that you can interrupt the cycle.
The Eightfold Path is the same path for everyone, but we engage with the path in infinitely different ways, depending on our own type of conditioned thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's a universal teaching. It's what the Buddha taught to address all the different problems of humanity rooted in ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
How we, and some people, dependent origination has great importance. To other people, it doesn't mean anything, and it doesn't really matter. The most important thing to remember about all of the Buddha's teachings is not the 12 links of dependent origination, but that ignorance of Four Noble Truths causes all manner of confusion, delusion, and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And that points directly to, okay, if I don't want to be ignorant, let me develop an understanding of Four Noble Truths.
And if it takes 17 different stories for 17 different people to arrive at that gate?
Well, look at the three different suttas that I'm teaching in this series. They're all taught to different people in different situations, and they all, the Mula Sutta that I'll teach on Thursday is a little bit different. It's not completely directly related to becoming, but it does. But they're all basically the same teachings. In this teaching, the Buddha's teaching his cousin, who was there for every teaching the Buddha ever gave, but yet he's expressing his confusion. Becoming, what is it? To what extent is there? He just doesn't understand it. So the Buddha used that, because he understood Ananda, he used that metaphor of the field.
But he has no chance if he doesn't ask.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's just something else the Buddha always said. If you're confused about anything, ask me directly. Ask me the direct question. Don't get into conjecture and speculation or listen to other teachings and try to fit it in. Ask the question. We're almost done, Diane. We're going
to
do the... All right. It's good to see you. All right, so a great class. We'll finish with the Metta Sutta. Just a couple of quick announcements. The pictures from the retreat are up. Great pictures. Was it you or Liz that sent me the... For some reason, I'll figure it out, but I've been sending it from my phone to my email, and I'm not... But they'll get up there. But Joe took some great pictures, and Maura sent some too. So the pictures are up. The talks are up, and the registration for October's retreat is up. So everything's all set. Any other questions or comments about tonight's talk? Okay, we'll finish with the Metta Sutta. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an ongoing expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward, and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Peace, peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction, and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.